Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will cause the greatest catastrophes of the next 100 years, and will we be prepared to cope with them when they come? In his highly influential 2005 book, The Long Emergency, James Howard Kunstler argued that peak oil and the growing shortages and rising prices that follow it will change nearly every aspect of the 21st century, moving Americans from a global, mobile, and consumer-centered existence to one that is local and low-tech. And he worries we are unlikely to handle those changes well. But is Kunstler correct? Are his predictions accurate? And do we have the power to do anything to prevent the hardships he describes? My guests today are here to discuss those questions. Todd Robertson is an editorial writer for the Dallas Morning News, which is discussing the long emergency this month in the newspaper and online at bookclubblog.dallasnews.com. Trey Garrison is a freelance writer who is a contributor to D Magazine and other publications. He's also a peak oil skeptic, and he's representing that point of view in the online discussions of the book. Finally, Jeffrey Brown is an independent petroleum geologist who agrees with Kunstler's core argument that we are quickly running out of oil and could face a radically different future without it. Guys, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Let's start with this, Todd. Will you give us, beyond what I just talked about, a general overview of the book and the positions it takes?
Well, it's largely an essay. It's almost like an editorial. It's one man's opinion of where we're heading. He tries to source some of it, but not all of it. So it's hard to get a sense of what parts of this are just his opinions and what parts are based on fact or the best we can determine as being the fact. The problem with oil is it's an unknown quantity. It's down below the surface of the earth, and we explore for it. We produce what we can, but we don't really know exactly how much is down there. So he makes the point that the earth's reserves of oil are about 2 trillion barrels, and of that, we've come to about 1 trillion in use. That means we've got about 1 trillion left. And of that oil, what we've produced so far is the most easily accessible oil. It's the highest quality oil. And what we've got left is harder to get to, low quality, and it's going to be more and more expensive to get to it as we proceed. Now, he also makes the point that the entire industrial age is predicated on the use of fossil fuels. And because we have wrapped ourselves around the use of fossil fuels in every aspect of our lives, untangling ourselves from that is going to be extremely difficult. For many of us, it's going to be impossible. And he says we're heading toward disaster because of that.
I can tell you from my own bookshelf that there are any number of books about the future of energy. What made this one right for a book club discussion?
Because he is so passionate about what he says. I'm not saying this is the best book out there on this subject. It may well be. Trey, I think you were the one who raised this point, that, or somebody on our blog raised the point that because he's written this book, he has started a conversation, a long overdue conversation, that our nation and the world needs to have. So it's a good way to get the conversation started.
Well, let's go next to you, Jeff. You're a geologist. In your estimation, Todd talked about not everything in the book being sourced in the way that works like this sometimes are. How good is the science?
He's probably largely basing a good deal of his work off work by Kenneth DeFees, who built on prior work by M. King Hubbert, who was sort of the one of the leading proponents of peak oil theory. And DeFees introduced some simple quantitative modeling that led him to estimate that we have conventional crude oil reserves of about 2,000 billion barrels. This doesn't count things like natural gas liquids and biofuels, and also the unconventional plays like the tar sands in Canada. But one point I would stress is that peaks happen. You know, Texas peaked in 1972 and we're down by 3/4. Lower 48 peaked in 1970, as did the total U.S., inclusive of Alaska. Russia peaked in a broad plateau in the 80s. The North Sea peaked in 1999. And on this model, the world is approximately where Lower 48, Russia, and the North Sea were when they peaked. And one other key point, Texas and North Sea were developed by private companies using the best available technology with virtually no restrictions on drilling. And they've shown a long-term decline. So, I mean, peaks happen even in the best of circumstances.
Trey, you've said peak oil may be something that we have to deal with, but peak energy may never take place.
Yeah, we've run out of all sorts of commodities throughout history. What happens is as supply decreases, demand either stays the same or goes up, the price makes it where finding alternatives, substitutions become more feasible and more profitable. You don't have to look very far, but over to, 20 years ago, the Barnett Shale was there. We weren't fracking over there because the technology wasn't there and the price of natural gas didn't justify it. Look what's happening now. That's just by way of example. We're already on the way with, the emphasis on alternative energy, with the emphasis on alternative fuels, and this is the market responding. People are buying hybrids. People are looking for other ways in which they can lower their, because the cost is going up, they're lowering their use of it. So between, I think these projections being somewhat pessimistic, everyone from a lot of people within the energy industry think that the 2 trillion barrels is maybe on the low side. So we have at least, another 30, 40 years before we hit the peak. That is plenty of time for us to make a transition, both for domestic on-the-grid uses of energy as well as for whatever may substitute one day for our cars.
We're talking with three of the folks who are involved in the Dallas Morning News book club blog that is discussing this month The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler. If you want to join our discussion, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It occurs to me, reading what you all have written and what's been posted by other people on the blog, that this is a conversation that maybe 2 or 3 years ago, not so many people could have had with access to facts and with a distinct position on the issue. This is something now that is really top of mind, more than it has been.
It really is. I mean, if you just look at, not to plug my own product, but if you look at the front page of the Dallas Morning News today, you've got Boone Pickens talk. It's an article about his strategy in promoting the increased use of wind energy and how to connect his major project in North Texas to the national grid. It's a really important step. But what it says is that this is becoming a part of the mainstream national conversation, and it involves a key figure, a man who has built his entire life around the production of oil and got rich off of it. Even he is saying we've got to move to something else.
I'm wondering what any of you think about this question. You know, in the 80s, there was a huge interest in hunger in Africa, and there were celebrities on the cause, and everybody suddenly understood that there were problems, and they were very worried about it. And then that sort of faded. And I'm wondering, without a precipitous drop in our lifestyles, without something changing further, whether you think this is something that we will focus on intensively, and I'm talking at the sort of consumer level, for a couple of years, and then without a great problem, will we forget that this is going on?
One thing we haven't talked about yet is net oil export capacity, and it's actually a far worse situation than peak oil. For example, the U.S. was a leading exporter in the 30s and 40s, and we became a net importer right after the end of the Second World War, more than 20 years before we peaked. So we would have, if the U.S. was the sole source of crude oil for the world, world oil exports would have ceased in around 1947, 23 years before world crude production would have peaked. Our models indicate we're looking at an accelerating decline rate. So I think we're actually only in the very early stages of the crisis, and I expect to see continued rapid increases in food and energy prices. So I don't think the crisis is going away.
So you think there's no chance we can sort of focus on something else in the near future? It's going to be greater and greater on our priority list?
Well, if you look what happened since May 2007 to June 2008, oil prices have risen at about 6% per month on average, and there were two monthly declines in August and December. So monthly prices really give you a better idea of what's going on. And, we're down slightly in July. We're going to be down in August, like August of last year. But that's what I expect to see, is brief pullbacks, and then importers bidding for declining oil exports. If I could say one thing, I think Trey and I both would like to congratulate and thank the Dallas Morning News editorial board for raising this subject. It's critically important. I think they're doing an excellent job.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to contribute what you're thinking about this issue, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak to Steve in Dallas. Hello, Steve.
Hi. I've been looking at this issue for about 2.5 years. Matter of fact, when I first discovered it, I went and found Jeffrey Brown in his office and knocked on the door and talked with him about it. And I've been looking at it since then. I'm 55 years old. I'm from East Texas, the oil patch down there. I have relatives in the oil business. And this, I mainly want to address Trey, the skeptic, on a couple of issues. One is this is more than a peak oil crisis. It is a two-pronged fossil fuel crisis of depletion and pollution. It involves more than oil. Coal can also be thrown in there on those two, one or both of those prongs. And to take the attitude that we've got plenty of time to let the market develop alternatives ignores the pollution prong of this crisis. We don't have time as far as that goes.
Well, let's give Trey a chance to respond. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Okay.
Well, I think the pollution issue is definitely separate. But going to the peak oil, where we are, how long we have, and that sort of thing, I wrote in my initial column that since the 1970s, throughout the 20th century, there have been four previous declarations of peak oil being reached, and all of them were wrong. And I was wrong there. Between 1972 and 2004 alone, there have been 36 declarations that peak oil had been reached. Every one of those were wrong. And looking at those, you can always find that it's almost constantly, we have 30 years out of oil or easily extractable oil. And it's sort of, I think the best analogy is, you know, how many weeks worth of food do you have in your pantry and in your refrigerator? A couple of weeks. That doesn't mean 2 weeks from now you're going to be out of food because you're going to replace it. Productivity, exports, all of these are a function of a lot of variables beyond, single static dynamics like, you know, what we're producing right at this moment right now. Price increases allow for more drilling, more exploration. When we start using less oil, then all of a sudden we find, reserves rise. It becomes less feasible to do more exploration or less useful to. And so, there are a couple of problems, and the reason that the peak oil theory is not really widely accepted yet in the mainstream of among energy economists is because it doesn't take into account things that are more fluid, including demand and that sort of thing.
Jeff.
2 points. One, I don't think anybody using the Hubbert Defee's quantitative method was looking at a world peak until around 2000 time frame. And in Hubbert's initial speech in 1956, he expected the peak. He didn't have a hard number, but expected to peak before 2006. And I got one other quick point.
Yeah, you've got time to make a quick
okay.
point.
There's a 2004 DVD, Into Suburbia, Oil Depletion and the Collapse of the American Dream. They warned about a collapse of suburban real estate values, rising food and energy prices. Dan Yergin said, we're going to looking at $38 a barrel as rising production force prices down. So, you know, look what's happened in the past 4 years. You know, to quote, paraphrase Reagan, are you better off now than you were in 2004? So who was more accurate in warning about what was happening?
We're talking about the issues raised by James Howard Kunstler's Long Emergency with people who are participating in the Dallas Morning News' book club blog. We'll return to our discussion in a moment. And you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are here to discuss The Long Emergency, the 2005 book by James Howard Kunstler. You can read about it at bookclubblog.dallasnews.com. You'll see things written by Todd Robertson, an editorial writer for the Dallas Morning News, Trey Garrison, who is a freelance writer and a peak oil skeptic, and petroleum geologist Jeffrey Brown. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Todd, I saw you wanting to respond after Trey spoke about the mistakes that we've seen in the past when the day of peak oil, the era of peak oil, has been declared multiple times, and apparently it hasn't been correct.
Well, I guess what I wanted to get to was kind of the point that Steve, the previous caller, made. What he was trying to do is link, point to the linkage between pollution and the use of fossil fuels. Trey said there not correct to necessarily link them. I think it's absolutely correct to link them. You can't separate the two, and whenever you get into any conversation about oil, you ultimately get to the question of global warming, global climate change, and pollution. You can't even discuss what's going on in the Olympics today without dealing with those two issues, and they're dealt with in the book as well as several other books that touch on this subject. The other point I was going to make is you mentioned how it's very hard to keep the public's attention focused on this. And it's absolutely correct. If you'll remember, before 2001, before the 9/11 attacks, the public was absolutely focused on the Kyoto Accords. It was absolutely front and center, the number one global topic of discussion. We easily got distracted, but for a good reason. 2005, at the Gleneagles G8 summit in the UK, again, the two main topics were supposed to be Africa and global warming. Then, just hours before the summit began, the subway attacks occurred in London. The entire press corps covering the G8 summit fled for London, and both of those very important topics got dropped.
Well, in some ways, I mean, I think it suffers from the problem of being almost like, you know, people who tomorrow are going to start a diet. You know, you eat a donut today, you don't instantly notice what's going on. And so it's easy to put that off because, you know, you've just had a fender bender with the car or some other things are happening.
One thing I don't necessarily agree with is that obviously any issue you want the public's attention, and these kind of things are a way to go about it. But when we faced these kind of problems before with shortages of any other commodities, it didn't take a top-down, grab the public's attention, make them go do this thing or another. Market forces basically dictated, for them. You know, when whale oil became scarce, prices for it just shot through the roof. People just adapted. They went to different we started adopting different technologies, and by the time whale oil was completely gone, no one even noticed.
Do you agree, though, with Kunstler, who says that virtually every luxury and everything that we're accustomed to in modern life is based around petroleum?
Yeah, but I think he gets the cart before the horse. He attributes pretty much all of the industriousness, man's advancement, what we've been able to do with technology, to oil, as if somehow it all sprang from oil itself. And I think that's where he has it backwards. We harnessed oil for our ends. And I think that, therefore, you know, oil is a very efficient means of producing energy. But without it, I think we can still find, we will still find other ways. And it's not just, you know, being Pollyanna and having, you know, blind faith in technology. It's pretty much the history of the last 200 years.
Phrase I'd like to use, which I posted on the blog, was incremental versus material. I essentially agree with Trey that there are substitutions, that there are alternatives. The question is, are they material? Like the tar sands in Canada, you know, clearly it's commercial, and they are slowly increasing their production, but their net oil exports, for example, were down last year, and their year-over-year exports to the U.S. are down by 6%. And we are going to, you know, do all kinds of different things, but the question is if it's material. But actually, in another way, I do slightly agree with Trey. There are different ways to live. And, you know, I think we're crippled by our addiction to the automobile. There's a great phrase, which is, I haven't found the attribution, but the quote was that the American love affair, like the automobile, is like the Stockholm Syndrome, and where the captives identify emotionally, you know, with the captors, with the people that took them hostage.
I was just going to say, I think Kunstler's point is that it's not so much limited to our transportation, our reliance on oil for transportation. It's every aspect of our life, and every aspect of the alternatives touch on the use of oil in some way. If you just look around this room, the telephone, the cords on the microphone, the cup in front of me, everything relies on oil in some way. The coatings, the plastics we use for the wiring. Even if we produce a solar panel, we must rely on oil for the energy to produce it and the materials that cover it. So it's very, very difficult, his point is, to divorce ourselves from this product. And it seems to me, although he seems to hold a very gloomy perspective of the future, it seems to me that if we are going to, if we accept that we will run out of this product at some point, we better get going on trying to find some kind of a substitute for it.
One of the things that Kunstler talks about is the death of things like big box stores. And he says what will happen is that it'll be harder to get the supply there. There won't be the supply of so many products that rely upon petroleum. And therefore, he thinks these stores will go out of existence and the American sort of consumer demand will change. And I have to wonder what all of you think about that, because there's this sort of, you know, the sense that the existence of the product drives demand. But I don't know whether demand would shrink up as quickly as the supply goes away.
Well, there's definitely the fashionable dislike of suburbia, of big box stores, of consumerism, whatever. I'm not really sure what that means.
I know you're making a point here, but you know what consumerism means.
I do, but people always seem to apply it to everyone else's choices but their own. It's always what you buy is crass consumerism. What I buy is something I need.
Right. Okay.
There's that sort of fashionable dislike of it, and I, you know, when we talk about and Jeffrey made a great point about needing a bigger investment in electrified transportation. Well, that's certainly going to actually be a way to help the traditional, or what we've come to know as the traditional just-in-time inventory business model. So, you know, I'm just not seeing. I think this book is an important book. I definitely encourage anybody to read it because it gets these kind of good discussions going. But I think my biggest criticism of the book is that Mr. Kunstler takes everything that he doesn't like about modern life and attributes it or pretty much says it's all going to go away because of the lack of oil. Nature is going to come and enforce my vision of the way life should be. And I'm just not seeing that. And he even kind of reaches far outside the boundaries of anything that could be touched by oil to talk about things that are going to go away. And so,
let me return to a point I made right before the break. The End of Suburbia DVD in 2004 prominently featured Jim Kunstler and a bunch of other peak oil experts. And they basically warned of three things: collapse real estate values in the suburbs and rapidly increasing food and energy prices. So I think everybody would agree that we've seen falling real estate values in suburbs to collapsing real estate values and rapidly increasing food and energy prices. Now, as you know, Trey and I have discussed, the primary reason, I think, for the mortgage meltdown is this giant buildup of debt. But in my opinion, rising energy prices were the trigger that set it in motion, and I think they're acting as an accelerant. You imagine a forest fire where tankers are dropping napalm instead of fire retardant. I think that's what's happening. And a friend of mine just sent me an email. Apparently Nightline last night profiled several people that were suffering badly and with these extreme commutes because of rising energy prices. And they had a case history of a couple that had a $1,200 a month house payment and a $1,500 a month gasoline bill. Their house is currently in foreclosure, and they've rented something now, a small apartment, close to where they live.
Well, I think we do need to keep that in perspective.
They work. Go ahead.
I think we do need to keep that in perspective. When, you know, the foreclosure rate is barely 1%, and so, you know, whether they're – you're right about the energy prices being accelerant on the problem. It's, you know, that's one out of 99, or one out of 100, rather. And the devaluation of a lot of the suburban ring property values it's the outer suburbs is where the new development is. And so builders go in and build a whole bunch of houses on spec. And so as soon as the market slows down, they're stuck holding the bag and they have to lower their prices because they don't, you know, if you're living in a house and you're trying to sell it, well, you can still live in it. A builder, an unsold house is just a liability. So they're cutting their prices, and I think that contributes to a lot of it. And I don't think we could ever look at any single market or submarket and, you know, take that and say, well, this is what's happening across the board.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Steve in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Chris. I just wanted to ask each of your guests, and I've read Kunstler's book and several other books on peak oil in the last year, and it's really interested me as a topic. And it seems like each one of the books focuses on mostly on energy return on investment as being the crux of the problem. And not that we're going to run out of oil. It's just that oil is going to become so expensive to get out of the ground, it's not really going to have any return value. And I think, just to quote some numbers off the top of my head, I think they said right now, currently, oil out of the ground is giving you a 30-to-1 ratio on energy input. So for every one input of energy you put in, you get 30 units out, whereas solar energy is 1.2-to-1. And I just wanted to see what your guests had to say about that.
Well, there's no question that oil does give a lot of bang for the buck. I don't think anybody would argue that.
Including Kunstler himself.
Exactly. I think he has a chart in here or a list of figures about, you know, the relative output of energy. And oil is absolutely, second to the top of the list. I think coal might be higher in terms of BTUs produced. But the point of his book is, be that what it may, we're running out of it. We've got to do something different about the way we consume this very precious product. So it does us no good to argue whether oil is somehow more efficient or gives us better output than solar or wind power. We've just got to try to find other sources of energy.
What do any of you make of the notion that he has that if we had a greatly diminished supply of affordable oil, that everything would change from the amount of education that we provide our children to the places that we go and the ways that we get around? He says, you know, automobiles will still exist, but basically they'll be for, you know, special occasions. Does anyone think that it's possible that we could move into a United States that looks that way?
I really do think that we will change the way we transport ourselves and run our lives. You can see it already as the price of oil goes up. More and more people are starting to ride motorcycles, Vespas. I know one man who runs a very prominent organization in the city of Dallas who drives around on a Vespa. I've seriously considered riding a bicycle to work, and I know other people at the Dallas Morning News already are doing that. This is something that you see in Europe all the time. People don't think twice about riding bicycles around, riding Vespas around where we would drive an SUV. So, yes, I do think this is going to be a pattern of the future. It's going to be more price-driven at this point because that's what is on people's mind. That's what they focus on. Now, what is going to be the very complicating factor on this, and Kunstler rightly points to this, is that so much of America is concentrated in the suburbs, and we commute to our work sometimes 20, 30, 40 miles to our work. It is not possible to think of riding a Vespa down the Central Expressway. It is not possible to think of riding a bicycle unless you plan to leave at 4:30 in the morning.
I wonder if that's an infrastructure question, though. Could that be solved with putting Vespa lanes on the freeway or making sure that you can bike places safely?
I think, you know, it would certainly help. And I gave a talk in Santa Barbara at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and it was fairly amazing. They had these dedicated bike lanes where pedestrians had to wait for the bikes, you know, to clear before the pedestrians could walk across. But a friend of mine has got some great case histories. Alan Drake has talked about Switzerland in World War II. They were cut off from oil and responded by electrifying their transportation system. Today, the average American uses as much oil as 400 Swiss used in 1945. So there are alternative ways to get around. Electric-powered streetcars, electric light rail, you know, maybe perhaps with hyper-efficient small electric vehicles and bikes and electric bikes to get to and from the mass transit systems. And then we can run that electrified transportation system off things like wind power and solar power. So, I mean, there are alternatives. If we think outside the auto-centric, you know, suburban big box, you know, concept.
What do you think, Trey?
I think he's absolutely right. I think all those are available to us. I don't think any of us can predict what people are going to want 5, 10, 20 years from now. However, alternately, you know, we're already seeing the development of other, you know, alternative forms of individually owned conveyances. Nissan just yesterday unveiled a prototype for an all-electric car. It's twice as efficient, and the battery holds twice the charge of anything to this point. It's going to be on the market by 2010. I think a lot of these options. I think a lot of people are getting more into mass transit. I think a lot of people are going to, you know, maybe look at living a little close to work. Although, if, you know, I think you really need to think that through. It's going to make changing your job a lot harder all of a sudden. But I think,
in other words, you have to think about how far you live from where you're going to go.
Yeah, and I think ultimately that you know, unless we see just a bottom up sea change in people's opinions, people like the freedom that their own whether it's however it's powered car gives them, and that's going to be hard to get rid of. And I'm not sure that, you know, we should try to force that. I think that the market will help, you know, determine, you know, whether that's going to be an option for people.
How adaptable are we, Todd?
I think we're pretty adaptable. You know, I've lived all over the world, and I've been pretty amazed at how people manage to survive under some of the most dire circumstances imaginable. I mean, if you go to places like Afghanistan or Iraq, Lebanon during the Civil War, or Bogota, Colombia, people adapt. They learn to live under the circumstances that they're presented with.
Todd Robertson, Trey Garrison, and Jeffrey Brown are my guests. We're talking about James Kunstler's 2005 book, The Long Emergency. You can read their work at bookclubblog.dallasnews.com. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Dallas Morning News' online book club, and it's also taking place in the paper in limited editions, is about the long emergency this month. You can check it out online at bookclubblog.dallasnews.com, or you can join our conversation right now by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's go right now to Andrew, who is in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a comment about the consumer culture, and I used to think it was somewhat negative, but we do create an economic engine for the world as well as for the United States, and I think that this is an opportunity for all of us to change and become a different kind of consumer culture that's actually, you know, beneficial to us and the world, kind of as the United States tradition. So that's, you know, I kind of hopefully have a more optimistic view of where things are going, and I'll just listen to some comments off the air.
Well, hold on, Andrew. So if we were going to shift our consumer culture, consumer culture in what way, then, that would be more positive?
Well, I don't know. That's something that Americans are pretty good at discovering. So, for example, I don't mind riding my bike to work every once in a while, but the Parks and Recs departments of every jurisdiction where I live in Dallas-Fort Worth, the Campion Trail, for example, is not connected up to Dallas yet, and it's strictly a minor little political problem that the Parks and Recs aren't involved in mass transit, for example, where it would be easy to ride your bike along the Elm Fork of the Trinity River all the way into Dallas.
Those kind of simple solutions
aren't. And I think as, you know, people become broke and have problems, that those kind of things will change at a local level, for example. That's one example, you know, high-tech bikes. I'd buy a new car right now. I want a new car, but I'm not going to buy one until I can get one that's 100 miles per gallon or all electric and can go at least 300 miles, and I can recharge it wherever I go. I'm originally from Detroit, so, for example, I agree that we are going to have a hard time weaning ourselves from our own individual transport pods, whatever those are going to be. And so I kind of see it as an exciting time of change, and people are going to have to be forced to be aware of what they're doing.
Sure.
I want to recycle, for example, and I always forget and throw things away. It's hard to change our ingrained patterns. But
okay, Andrew, those are great points, and I know everybody wants to respond, so we'll start with Todd. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
His main point is very well taken. I like to challenge people every now and then. Go around, just drive around or bicycle around on bulky trash day and just look at the things that people leave out on their curbside. The mountain of boxes and unused household items, just the things that they buy. And if you look at the condition of some of these things, apparently never use. If you look at the way people exercise, it is amazing to me. People get on electric machines, electric treadmills. They need electricity to make them exercise. Why not find a way to run that treadmill so that you're the one generating the electricity instead of using the electricity? It just strikes me as odd the way inventors in this country find ways to help us consume energy, waste energy, when it's not really necessary for us to do that.
I like what Andrew had to say because he really represented what's going to transition us very smoothly into this. He said it himself, I'm not going to buy a car until I can get one that gets me 100 miles per gallon. Individual choice he's making, it's made all over the country every day, and these are the kind of things that are going to bring about these kind of more fuel efficiencies, less pollution, and all these things that we say we want. And I think he's absolutely right that this is a very positive time. Pretty much think all times are pretty positive times. Kunstler's, I think, his biggest problem is he peddles pessimism and sort of presents it as analysis. And it's just inevitable. He actually peddles inevitability. And what I'm seeing, though, is even if he's absolutely right on all these points, these are opportunities. This is somebody's going to get rich solving these problems. And I think that's, and it's because somebody is going to get rich that these problems will get solved. So I'm kind of excited about it. That's why I said, even though I don't really agree with much of what the man has to say, I think it definitely gets the conversation going, and it sort of exercises your ability to weed through a different viewpoint and kind of take from it, what you can, and challenge your own positions.
Jeff, do you think it's possible to do this with conversions rather than cutbacks?
Yes, and I think, basically we're going to be, even if you don't choose it voluntarily, we're going to be forced into it. And personally, I think rather than, looking for a super efficient, vehicle, just sidestep the whole issue and get out of the car culture and arrange your life so that you can, minimize your use of the automobile and then live where you work where you live. And even here in Dallas, it's possible to do it, at least to some extent. My daughter and son-in-law, for example, she has a job in Dallas. He has a job in Fort Worth. So they located along the TRE line. He drops her off at the train station. She takes a train over to UT Southwestern, has about a five-minute walk to her job. So, they get by on one car and have minimized their commute and live in small, energy-efficient housing in a new urbanism community. So even here in Dallas-Fort Worth, you can make some smart choices. And to the extent you can, get away from the car culture.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Van in Dallas. Hi, Van.
Hi. I just wanted to state, I kind of agree with Trey. I think that the peak oil is definitely a little bit too dramatic and too of a pessimistic view of what's going on. But, I think there are some really definite facts that you got to look at. As a country, we represent 4% of the world's population, and yet we use 25% of the world's petroleum products consumed. And developed nations such as France and Italy and Germany, they use less than half per capita of the petroleum that we do, and yet they enjoy very good standards of living. So I think you know, it was mentioned earlier about the oil sands in Canada. Evidently, they estimate that those sands have as much as the known petroleum reserves for the world. So there's all these other alternatives out there. But the one thing that I kind of look at is we've been so programmed on cheap energy and being wasteful about it. And I just think it's time that the government mandates a particular price like they do in Europe on a non-renewable resource to help us wean ourselves off of this. And, you know, I'm not talking about a drastic increase, but something that will encourage even a faster movement away from gas guzzlers and consuming too much energy. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay.
Well, I liked everything he had to say for the most part, except for that last bit. I don't know that we've ever had a price control that worked out well in really any economy, especially when you're talking about a commodity. I think that's really probably the worst thing you could possibly do.
Well, as Trey knows, the reason that they've got the per capita energy consumption in Europe is half of what it is in the U.S. is they tax it. And, you know, if I were energy czar and had dictatorial powers, I would abolish the payroll tax, which is used to fund Social Security and Medicare, and replace it with a tax on energy consumption. And two, you know, political odd, you know, bedfellows, Boone Pickens and Al Gore, have not quite endorsed that, but they endorsed much higher gasoline tax offset by cutting the payroll tax. And in fact, Boone Pickens, lifelong Republican, Texas oil man, you know, endorsed it before Al Gore did, lifelong Democrat and environmentalist. So, you know, I don't think this is a political left-right issue. I think it's, you know, you either recognize, you know, resource limits or you don't.
There are some sort of Freakonomics type studies, though, that look at systems like that where you penalize oil consumption by putting a very large tax on it. And what happens is that people say, well, I've paid my $6, and so I'm going to drive as much as I want, as opposed to being sort of morally obligated to conserve.
Well, it preserves a free market system. So if you want to drive a $50,000 SUV to and from a 50-mile commute to and from a $500,000 mortgage,
many of us would like to have that problem, I guess. But
or in the alternative, if you want small energy-efficient housing along a mass transit line like Uptown or Mockingbird Station, or, you know, pedal your bike to the train station, you know, you would have a tax cut. But people persisted in driving a SUV to a suburban mortgage would have a big tax increase.
Well, if you look at the European example, I lived in London for 3 years, and boy, there is no question that they love to tax the use of fossil fuels. And the question is, two questions. One, does it work? And number two, would Americans accept a similar tax? When I was living there, I was paying roughly $7.50 to $8 a gallon, and people did not blink at that. And most of that was taxes. What it goes to, it goes to help fund their healthcare system. It helps to fund mass transit systems, which I think are incredibly efficient. You could get anywhere in the city of London without any problem whatsoever. Try to do that in Dallas or in Houston. You cannot duplicate that kind of a system, and you're going to need something to fund it. And so I'm not entirely opposed to the idea of taxing the use of oil. It discourages people from wasting this very valuable product. Will Americans accept it? I don't know. I imagine we'll hear from some callers on that.
Let's go next to Rebecca in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Hi, Rebecca.
Oh, hi. Well, I'm actually visiting Texas right now. I'm at my mother's in Grand Prairie.
Welcome.
But what I'd like to say is, I'm not sure the name of the talker who was just on talking about.
That was Todd.
Todd. Okay. Hi, Todd. You're right in that about London, getting around London. It's still that way. And what we need to think about in this country, and especially a place like Texas, is that, you know, not everybody lives in a city where you can utilize rapid transit that gets around the local metropolitan area, say like Dallas-Fort Worth. If people live out away from the city and need to go into town, those people are already conscientious about saving their money letting go of some of the trucks. You know, where I live is it's a small town. There's rice growing around the area up in Jonesboro. I'm up there going to school. And when you drive between, say, Jonesboro and heading toward Little Rock and heading this way, you see the people who would be hanging on to trucks that they use in their business. The trucks are sitting down by the road for sale. And gas guzzlers.
You've made some great points, Rebecca, and I need to make sure that we have time for everybody to respond. But I think she's talking about there would be a huge retrofitting required in this country to get us to a place approximating what Europe has been building up for 40 years.
We will see that. I think what we're going to see at the start is kind of a transition phase where the two Hummer family is going to become the one Hummer family and maybe a very small economic station wagon or something like that. I know in our house we've got one small car, and we've got a car that we use to haul stuff, lumber and big items that we need a big car for. How long that'll last, I don't know. But I do think we are going to see a transitional phase where people are going to consider whether they really need two cars or three cars in their driveway. They can get rid of one of them. They can maybe even get rid of two of them, consider other modes of transportation.
Well, Jim Kunstler has long described suburbia as the biggest misallocation of resources in the history of the world, and I substantially agree. Even as he said, we've invested so much of our post-World War wealth, which is dependent on an infinite supply of cheap energy. You know, a lot of the discussion Trey and I have had is how much of this is going to be written down. But I think a lot of the suburban real estate is basically going to be written off. Now, there's one qualification. We might be able to rehabilitate some of these areas into more local communities around local food production, maybe a little local networks of electrified transportation. But I think, you know, things are changing dramatically.
Trey, last 30 seconds goes to you.
I'm just not seeing it. 52% of people choose to live in suburbs. Certainly, mass transit has become more popular, and I think we're all looking for ways to cut our fuel costs. So hybrids, electric cars, and all that's going to become more popular. But the long emergency really isn't coming the way Mr. Kunstler predicts. It's going to be a very slow, gradual transition. It's going to be so painless, I think, that we're not really even going to notice it because it's going to be fueled by our choices. And, ultimately it's going to be, no one can predict what living lifestyles will be 50 years from now. But I don't see it being this emergency-driven catastrophic change that Mr. Kunstler predicts.
The book we've discussed today is called The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler. You can read more about the analysis of the book in the Dallas Morning News or at bookclubblog.dallasnews.com. Thanks to Trey Garrison, Todd Robertson, and Jeffrey Brown. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.